Welcome back to First Edition on this on this Monday evening. I'm your host, Catalina Bird, sitting in for Sean Yo's social media. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at First Edition 889. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition. Also, connect with Sean on his personal Twitter account at Sean Yo's and FB personal page, Sean Yo's, with info, insight, and breaking news. Later on in this hour, we'll say goodbye to one of the greatest of all time. Gwen Ifill passed today. She was an award-winning journalist for PBS and NBC and former reporter for the New York Times and personally one of my role models in this work as a black woman who covers politics. But now we speak with Roger Hartley, Dean of College of Public Affairs and Professor of Political Science at the University of Baltimore, to continue our election aftermath conversation. Why didn't Clinton win? Change.org has over 4 million signatures to make Hillary Clinton president on December the 19th and needs 162,370 more to reach their goal. Roger, welcome to First Edition and thanks for joining us.
Catalina, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's terrific to appear on First Edition. Thanks so much.
Thank you. So I personally did not sign this petition. I think that it is a bad decision, but I'm interested in what you think and why so many people are signing it and hoping in doing more research in the Electoral College and what happens on December 19th.
I agree with you. I haven't signed the petition yet either, and I understand, absolutely, we all understand how cycles like when a candidate wins the popular vote and loses the Electoral College, why they might want to change in the system. Change in the system, though, as we both know, is extraordinarily hard. It takes a constitutional amendment when we've only had 27 of those in our entire history as a nation. It doesn't mean that they don't happen, obviously, but it's a tall, tall order for that to occur. And the other issue is what I learned years ago in political science courses as a graduate student is when you change the institutional framework of a system on the moment's notice for your own purposes and your own interests at that moment, several years later or 10 years later, they can come back and bite you.
Exactly. And so I tried to tell people, and there's been so much emotion around this election, and I try to give a more pragmatic and emotionally intelligent response. And when I say it, I think it's a bad idea, even if they figured out how to do it or did change their votes and elect Hillary Clinton, that I think that we could actually end up having an uprising in the country. This feels way different than Al Gore and Bush. But at the same time, it's making people, I think, who haven't learned civics, have to study the Constitution just a little bit more to come to understand what the purpose of the Electoral College is and what the Founding Fathers were trying to protect the country from in its creation and why. How do we change that without doing it in this emotional moment, like you said, and creating a backlash later to come?
Absolutely. Well, you know, and if I didn't understand your question earlier, I mean, there's a couple ways to look at this. There's changing the entire system, but as you said, getting the Electoral College electors that were already pledged to Donald Trump and pledged to Hillary Clinton, either or, to switch their votes would cause a serious lack of legitimacy in our political system. And I agree with you. This does feel a lot different than Bush v. Gore did. Emotions were very high then, but it was all placed on counting the votes and making sure that those votes in Florida were counted correctly. And there was a lot of emotion about that, but it's a different type of emotion to say that asking Trump pledged electors to switch their vote, to say the least, the other side would feel. Just imagine how we would feel, or anyone would feel, if it was their side,
right,
being asked to change their vote.
It's interesting because in my Uber over here to the station, my driver had told me that he did not vote since Gore v. Bush as a result of this, and that And so, like, moments like these are where apathy is born, in my opinion, and how we lose voters and how we lose them from the process. 47 million people didn't vote in this country on election day or early voting, you know. And so, like, these kinds of moments that make politics look rigged or illegitimate is feeding the apathy that is how 47 million people stay home.
Oh, Catalina, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, it's one thing for us to feel that in the system we have, it would have, like, putting myself into the shoes of a Clinton supporter for a moment, it's one thing for us to feel like, wow, we got more actual popular votes. That should matter, but our system doesn't work that way. It's a second thing to say that the way the system works with electors, that we should do a switcheroo. People do really feel that when they're voting in our system and they capture a state in their electoral votes, that those electoral votes really mean something. And that would be a titanic shift in our trust, I think.
Absolutely. I tried to encourage some people that were protesting in different places around the country, you know, instead of shutting down highways, find out who the electors are in your respective state. Because the only scenario that I see, and I have already, and myself personally, just made my peace with a Donald Trump presidency many, many months ago. I had called that election for the Republicans. But the only thing that I see that doesn't create a turmoil on both sides is if for some reason the Electoral College voted on December 19th to elect John Kasich. And I say this, the country still gets its white man. The Republicans still get the White House, and it's not Donald Trump. But there are fines associated, is my understanding, in some states with changing your vote once you've already pledged it. And so that might not be something that any of them.
Yeah. And even that, I think, would be highly unlikely. I think you're right. I think now there are people who are angry and there are people who are happy, but everyone is accepting the notion that there will be a Trump presidency. And then think about activism. Let's say you and I are both activists and we disagree with the Trump presidency. Do you really want to put your time and your energy and your activism into the Electoral College, or do you want to place it into advocating for the policies that matter to you, to protesting the type of things that could happen to people who you support and love, to building a political process that will actually put you on track to winning the next election, or even holding the other side's feet to the fire when they pose something important? Is that more better energy, or is it better energy to attack the electoral system and the credibility of the system?
I agree with you, and it sounds like you are a pragmatist like myself, but
maybe a bit too much sometimes. But yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that we're what's needed right now, because again, I come back to the use of the terminology of emotional intelligence. That we can't govern emotionally, and we also can't organize or strategize emotion from an emotional place just because we don't like what we got. And I liken a lot, and I have a lot of respect for activists. I'm not one, but it would appear to me that it would be a more useful use of energy to either look at organizing around the Electoral College or how we change this process in a way that doesn't have a backlash effect for anybody so that the country continues to go forward. But that's not what I'm seeing or hearing in the atmosphere around, you know. It's just more of the reasons I have not heard anybody talk about organizing around midterms when they're going to be so important in 18, and those guys already know who's running, and finding somebody to run and making it so that we are creating a path to going forward and a better America and a more unified America. Because a lot of people seem to have woken up Wednesday and really did not know that we didn't live in a post-racial country just because we elected President Obama.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that protest absolutely matters. I often talk about, you know, to my classes, I used to teach conflict management before I became a dean over here at University of Baltimore, but I used to talk about protest as a form of negotiation. It's a form of getting people's feet and their bodies to the table, to the negotiating table. And even then, it sends a really terrific and important message to someone. If you're concerned right now about having your friends and family deported under a new Trump administration to come out and speak this forcefully may lead him to think twice or think carefully, or members of his own party to think carefully about, do they want to go that far?
Well, I read something.
And he's already walking back a little bit on some of the policy issues he, trumpeted during the campaign. That makes a difference.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. I'm Catalina Berg, sitting in for Sean Yoes, and we are speaking with Roger Hartley, Dean of College of Public Affairs and Professor of Political Science at the University of Baltimore. And you're absolutely right. He's already backpedaling, Roger. He's taken the ban on Muslims off of his website very quietly. Paul Ryan said today that there is no active strategy on the GOP side for mass deportation. Let's take some callers. Let's see where the community is now. I haven't been over here since the election last week. Let's see if anybody calmed down. Big Al, you've been holding. Good evening, and welcome to First Edition.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be able to speak with you. One of the things that disturbs me about these demonstrations are, you know, we had a situation where black men were being gunned down in this country at a very horrible rate. The guy in New York being choked, a little child being gunned down with a toy gun. There were no mass demonstrations all over the United States. They were just paltry assemblies. They were, you know. But now all of a sudden we have an election and the whole world's coming to an end. You know, to me, that speaks volumes of what people really think of, about black people.
Thank you, Big Al.
Go
ahead, Roger.
Thank you, Al. I appreciate your comment quite a bit, and it's extremely thoughtful, and you have me thinking about that. Several ways of looking at it. You're absolutely right. There were protests, and there were people in the streets after those incidents, and absolutely the Black Lives Matter organization and movement is part of that. But was it nationwide? Was it in every city at every time? I think no. You're right. What may be happening here, though, is that that message, along with all of the other frustration that people have seen on that side of the political fence, has built up, and now they see in the embodiment of this new administration the potential of having everything go awry. Whether that's fair or not, boom, you get the protests. And there were the Occupy protests before, but your point is extremely well taken.
And you know, Roger, one of the things that I find most disheartening about these protests is I have to bring it back to emotional intelligence and the fact that we already see him backpedaling. And then remember that Donald Trump is a Democrat who became a Republican to run in their party. So the idea or the notion that he didn't say the things he knew he had to say to get elected, but knows that he's not really going to do, I don't think that that narrative is being used enough to calm people's emotions and help them think more clearly. Do you?
No, I agree with you, and I think we're all at a what do we make of this is the question going in everybody's head right now, because you are seeing him back off of his campaign rhetoric. On one hand, it makes you wonder, what are his loyalist supporters who wanted those things thinking right now, or is it okay that he has won and they're there? Then others perhaps are thinking, is there some political space right here to have my issue right now, say on infrastructure that we care about here in Baltimore and cities all over the nation, is there political space here to get something done that's really important with a person that we're not quite sure what he believes right now? Not to be flippant, but truly, it's hard to pin him down exactly on what he believes. He could be anything as president right now.
Exactly.
I think some people would argue.
His narcissism is not going to let him fail. So he's going to put smart people around him, I think it's safe to assume. And it might be okay. I want to go to some more callers. Aaron's calling from Baltimore. Good evening, and welcome to First Edition. Aaron?
Good evening, Aaron.
Do we lose Aaron?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Okay, there you go. Hey, brother, how are you?
Fine. One is organized around the 2018 midterms, which I've already begun doing. The second one is, well, you got to blame the candidate herself. Hillary Clinton didn't offer much that would make people excited enough to go out and be enthusiastic about her. And the Democratic Party, you have to fault them because they nominated the wrong candidate. I think if they nominated Bernie Sanders or Vice President Biden, it might have been a different showing than they had.
Thanks a lot, Aaron. You know I agree with you. I said it for a year. Clarence has been holding, calling from Baltimore. Good evening, Clarence, and welcome to First Edition.
Hey, thank you for taking the call. Professor, you know, those people that are out there protesting, what the reason they're protesting, in my view, is beyond Donald Trump. They're protesting for a whole litany of things. Most of those people are appalled at Freddie Gray, those types of incidents.
Absolutely.
Most of those people are, yes, it's a litany of things. For instance, the Constitution saying not we the people, but we the Electoral College and we corporate America. You know, that you can start with Donald Trump and then you can filter on down through everything that's happened in America and with police brutality to corporate rule to the Electoral College. It's a litany of things there, and you cannot just separate what those people are out there protesting for, because if you ask them, give me 10 things that's got you out here right now, you probably get a litany of answers there, to include everything, the few that I just mentioned. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Clarence.
Clarence,
go ahead, Roger.
Thank you. Clarence, thank you. I definitely wanted to respond to that. I think you nailed it. I think the embodiment of all of those things, all of those frustrations have come out in this loss or this win or victory by Donald Trump, because he was, for many, the embodiment of policies that would harm African Americans and Hispanics and Latinos. You ask a different protester, they may say, this is about women. This is about my rights. This is about my ability to raise a family. To someone else, it's about climate change. I think if we went out in the streets right now and started talking to people, you would find that they share a lot of views, but their reason for being there could be something very, very different.
Well, Roger, you know what I noticed going into the elections, I did a lot of foreign press, especially in Germany. I'm not clear how I became so popular in Germany, but
fantastic.
When I listen to people who are from other countries, how much of an impact do you think the Green Party and Libertarian parties can have? Can we build around both parties are flawed and have issues? And I just received a message from the Baltimore City Green Party chair here in Baltimore saying that he's growing the Green Party as a result of these elections as Democrats continue to implode because they don't seem like they've learned anything from this election. Their candidates won in Baltimore and in Maryland where we are and not on the presidential level. And so the rebuilding of the Democratic Party doesn't seem to be something that they're focused on. Do you notice that? And do you think there's an opportunity for us to be more like other countries and have more than just two powerful parties and have five or six represented at one time in our different bodies?
I think there is definitely interest in that. And I think, you know, one thing that we're noticing is that each year, year after year, the number of people who declare themselves unaffiliated or undecided as a party or independent as a party is growing and growing and growing. And that means that the loyalties to the current parties are not there.
I'm one of those people. I've been unaffiliated since I was 18 and registered to vote.
In most states, it's a plurality. I mean, it's the not a majority, but it's a plurality in most states, independent or unaffiliated. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're ripe to jump into being a Libertarian Party member or a Green Party member, but both of those parties have definitely benefited from this by getting their ideas out there. Now, it's a tall order, though, for us to become a parliamentary system where multiple parties have power. We have single-member districts that we vote in where there's winner-take-all. That's a structural problem. The two parties have great advantages on ballot access laws. You know, some of my colleagues who are in the Green Party said after this election, we had to get 25,000 signatures just to get on the ballot. The other two parties don't have to do that.
And those are the kind of things I want us to be organizing around policy to change. I want to get to the other three callers real quick before as time runs out.
Please.
Ayanna, you've been holding. You're calling from Baltimore. Good evening and welcome to First Edition.
Good evening. I wanted to speak about the comment about the emotional intelligence. I feel as though, I don't know, that could be a little insulting when you think about how impactful, as the gentleman said, this election was to what Trump embodies. You know, I'm an educator, and I've had students last week come into school that were really afraid and petrified about some of the things that they heard Donald Trump say, and then to see him be a leader. You know, parents talk about what am I to tell my child? So, I mean, I think it's a little deeper than just, okay, so let's go ahead and galvanize right away. I think people had to process, okay, oh my gosh, what does this mean for my family? What do I tell my children? Then the other side of that, I was at the protest last Thursday, Baltimore North, and what I saw was such a diverse group of people, and you did have Black Lives Matter, you did have transgender people. And what I got from that as an African-American person is that I think now it is really time to unify all of these messaging and really, you know, galvanize together. I think it's been an individual, you know, call for different groups at different times to protest about different things. But I feel like if we were all to collectively come together, that would really be a powerful voice. And then the other piece, last thing I wanted to say is that I feel like people in places like WEAA need to really inform communities about what these elections really mean. Who are these people? What is it? What are the corporations they're connected to that continue to hold communities down? Because I would like to know on a broader level, okay, well, who's connected to this? How does this impact me? Because when I talk to people, they didn't really have a clear sense about how important the vote would be if I choose a particular person. So I think, like, we really need to educate the community, the millennials, even those that are older, about what these elections really mean. This president has, you know, presidents have the power.
I don't want to cut you off, but I have two more callers I want to get to, and we're running out of time in this segment. But those are all good suggestions, and we do try to do that, Ayanna, and I thank you. Really quickly, I want to go to Bernard. If you can make your comment in 10 seconds, I'm sorry. Good evening. Welcome to First Edition.
Yes, I have to disagree with that. I think we need the demonstration along with boycott. Put those two together, I think you will get some results. As a Black man, I always said I'm 79 years old. I want to do something. I mean, I don't have to. I'm retired and well off, but I still want. I want to demonstrate. I want to connect with someone to do something. I've heard since the election on Sean's show about the Green Party. That's your party in this country. Whether you like it or not, you have to play the hand that you're dealt. We're not like England have three or four parties.
I appreciate. So, I don't want to cut you off, Mr. Bernard. I do, but I have one more caller that was holding before we have to let Mr. Roger go. Tweku, I'm sorry if I'm saying your name incorrectly. You're calling from Washington. Good evening and welcome to First Edition.
Yes, good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, I just need you to make it real quick, though.
Yes, my name is Tukumo. This election tells us, all of us, that there is a guy that's threatening not to accept the election results should he lose. And all of a sudden, he wins. What does that tell us?
I appreciate that. Roger, I'm going to let you have 10 seconds to respond to that, and we really do have to get out to our break.
I just wanted to say the callers all make incredible points. This has been a really terrific show. You have a really incredible listenership, and WEAA, I have to thank you so much for having me on tonight.
You're awesome. We're definitely going to have you back, so thank you.
This is one of those things where I think we could have talked for 3 or 4 hours, and I think a lot of people want to talk really badly right now.
They do. So Roger Hartley, Dean of the College of Public Affairs and Professor of Political Science at the University of Baltimore, thank you for joining us. We're going to go to a quick break, and up next is the legendary journalist has ended her battle with cancer. First Edition says goodbye to Gwen Ifill. This is First Edition on WEAA. Welcome back to First Edition. I'm your host for the evening, Catalina Byrd, sitting in for Sean Yost on the beautiful campus of Morgan State University, home of WEAA 88.9 FM. Whew. Okay, so I'm going to get through this segment without getting emotional because it's a lot today. I'm joined by Charles Robinson of State Circle on Maryland Public Television, and we're going to be saying a goodbye to Gwen Ifills, who, for me, was one of the only women in this profession of being a journalist as a woman of color that covers politics specifically that I had to look up to and to really because of the spaces that she was in and her access. I'm taking cancer has just been showing up this year. And Charles, you're with us. I know that this news didn't hit you any softer than it did me.
I was watching the president live, and when he announced it, and I was like, "What?" First and foremost, just by way of background, Gwen Ifill worked here in Baltimore for the Evening Sun, and she covered the state legislature. And there was an attempt by Maryland Public Television in those days to come up with shows that would showcase reporters. And one of those was a young lady by the name of Gwen Ifill. So we're talking about in the early 70s. Gwen was a regular predated State Circle. It was a show called News Wrap. And it was her first time ever being on television. And so she had to learn the nuances of being on television. But I wasn't here then, but the guy who hired me, his name is Everett Marshburn, hired her. And he used to joke about, yeah, I hired Gwen and put her on television for the first time. I would run into Gwen at every NABJ conference. She was a fixture. I'll never forget my wife and I walking through a mall in Las Vegas, and her and Michelle Norris were walking down a hallway, and we stopped them, and we just started having a conversation. One of the things that is very interesting about Gwen are some of the stories. You mentioned the fact that, she was your role model. Gwen was well aware that there were little black girls all over the United States who would see her on television and would come to the simple conclusion, I can do this.
Yeah, we talk so much about representation in media and spaces where we see ourselves in. I'm much younger than you, as you all always remind me, but I'm still old enough to know when she was the only black woman I saw on my TV doing this job that I want. And when I saw her moderate the vice presidential debates, it was a big deal. I will get to that level if I maintain my professionalism and my integrity in the way that I come to this craft that is journalism, and I too will get to moderate a presidential or vice presidential debate. And it just hit me so hard today about who is the Gwen Ifill of now that's left with that same decorum and that same testament of integrity and professionalism to this craft that our girls can see now.
There are several of them.
I have a daughter.
There are several of them.
Liz Tamron Hall.
Let me talk about my good friend April Ryan. She is devastated today. Understand this. When you work as a White House correspondent, you're in a very select group. And once you're there, you get your name etched on a book that literally says you worked at the White House. Gwen was one of the first ones to do that when the New York Times sent her down to Washington to work at the White House. But she wasn't the only one at that point. She was joined later by my good friend Sonia Ross, who works at Associated Press. These days, your daughter should look up to our good friend April Ryan. April's been doing a lot of television recently. In fact, I want to make sure you come. April will be the keynote speaker at the Kappa Phi Lambda MLK celebration. And I want to say it's January, I want to say the 15th. I'm going to get the right date.
Well, I have both of her books, and I've met Miss April a number of times. because of her involvement here at WEAA and just being from Baltimore. And there, and you know, my daughter does like watching Joy Reid. And she's three, but
right.
she's got the news bug. And there's Tamron Hall. And so there are others.
Right.
But I feel like as we went into this 24-hour news cycle and the business of how we did news change, has it become so much more entertainment heavy and personality heavy and not policy and fact driven? And so some of those are really great people to watch and see on TV, but I don't know that they give me the same emotions that Miss Eiffel did.
Oh, well, let me just tell you, Gwen was one of a kind. You know, she used to tell a story about when she worked at the New York Times and she would come in late in the evening and one of the security guards thought she was a maid.
Hmm.
But I want to talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about those things that made Gwen special. So if you remember, there was questions about whether or not she should do the vice presidential debate with Sarah Palin and Joe Biden, because word had leaked that she was going to release a book. And the book was going to be about the Obama presidency. And there was this buzz that was going around. And literally a week later, Saturday Night Live does a spoof of the debate.
Mm-hmm.
And Queen Latifah is playing Gwen.
Mm-hmm.
So I see Gwen literally 2 weeks later. I said, okay, Gwen, what'd you think of the spoof of you doing the debate? Well, hell, Charles, they got Queen Latifah to play me.
Right.
and it just cracked you up because she knew who she was, and the fact that someone of Queen Latifah's stature would play her, you know, she was tickled pink by that. One of the times that really kind of made you kind of think and wonder happened to me. You know, I go to the political conventions all the time. So I'm in Charlotte. This is during the last run of Barack Obama. And they announced the lineup for who were going to do the debates. And I am one of the co-founders of the NABJ Black Political Reporters Task Force. And the thing that was glaring, there were no persons of color asked to moderate the debate. So I'm in the hallway in the main convention center, and I see Gwen. I say, Gwen, I'm just devastated that you weren't on that list. She pulls me aside, because I've known her for a while. She says, Charles, there were forces beyond my control that didn't want me to do the debate. I said, Gwen, do you need us to make a big stink about this? Because this is horrible. Charles, just let it go. I said, you got to give me more than that. And she said that these forces, understand this, there is a commission on presidential debates. One of the individuals is a guy named Mike McCurdy, who was Bill Clinton's press secretary. There's another woman, and there's a Republican guy. And they were being influenced by white men who made this assumption that Gwen has disqualified herself because she had written a book.
Hmm.
And I said to myself, wait a minute. And I'm going to say this metaphorically. I said, half them fools have written books too.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the hypocrisy. As I'm listening to you tell this story, it sounds so hypocritical because as journalists, that's one of the things that we do, because this is not the work you go into to get rich.
Right.
We all write books.
Right.
You know, people keep asking me where my book is, and I just, every time I think I have it done, something else happens in politics that I feel like needs to be covered, and then I start all over. But right. that is part of our stream of income and our revenue outside of journalism, so that we can take care of our families. The fact that that would even be considered right. a disqualifier is so hypocritical.
Right. And she just said, Charles, let it go. I didn't want to, but it was Gwen. And I just let it go. But know this. Just like she influenced you, I'm always reminding journalists of all ilks. There are people watching you. There are people modeling themselves after you. There are people who are saying, you know what? If she can do this, I can do this. And you'll never, ever know who you touch And I was one of those people who was touched by somebody that I saw on television. And it gave me the gumption to think I could do this. I mean, literally. I mean, you know, I went to school in the capital of the Confederacy. So you could imagine when they see a black guy who speaks English, right. And I used to get that all the time, you know, you could speak English. I was like, well, I don't know what they speak in your house, but they speak English in my household.
Right.
You know.
And it's funny that you say that, because, you know, until you asked me earlier this year in the primary, I'd not ever been asked before to come and let our student journalists here at the school interview me around election coverage. And so when I did it for the general election last week, I was so in awe of the fact that not only was I interviewed by the anchor was a young black woman like myself, but all of the camera people were black women too. It felt so good to be over in that studio being a part of how they're learning and what they're learning about this craft. And I try to always be patient because I know they're students,
right.
and they think that I'm more important than I am. And so like they're trying to rush themselves. And I'm like, just take your time, learn your process. I'm here. And I don't remember having a lot of that locally because of a number of different factors, and to include my politics, from black women in media. I gained it as I started doing more things in D.C. and stuff like that. But I'm thankful to you for allowing me to be that with these girls here, because no one had ever made the ask before.
Well, as I've always told you, it's never about me. It never, ever has been. And, you know, I drag you. I say, come on, go with me somewhere. You're like, where the heck are you taking me? Because I know that there are, you know, Catalina, you know, I could easily make money on election night, you know, but I give it up.
Right.
Because I work with the kids. And this year I work till about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. And I always remind the kids, this is what it's about. Because at some point, Charles will not be here. You know, and I hope that you got the bug that I got. And if you get the bug, then come on and meet a bunch of kind of people that you never want to meet. You know, people always joke. They go, Charles, how do you know all these people? I said, I've been in politics too long. You know,
right. I'm trying to get out.
No, you don't want to get out. It is unfortunately, it is like a drug that you can't get off of. You love it, and you just can't get enough of it. I hate to use that metaphor, but literally it is. You know, I have had the pleasure of seeing people at the beginning of their careers. I met a young Ken Blackwell, and I run into him in airports, and he stalks me every time I see him. You know, I met a guy named Raynor Jackson, mm-hmm. who a lot of people go, he's ignorant. I said, no. He's on to something.
He's opinionated.
Right. He's on to something.
He's not ignorant. He's definitely Raynard is a special one.
Right. And you realize that, you know, I write about black politics, and I'm trying to get you to sit down for a minute so I can finish doing this piece that I'm writing about the state of black politics. But
should have been in the studio. I'm sitting down for 2 hours right now.
Okay, well, you're working, so. But anyway, look, we're talking about Gwen Ifill. And I hope the public understands that someone like Gwen comes along once in a lifetime. You know? Yeah. And she has influence that goes well beyond what you saw on the screen, what you read about her, and her many travels. I can't tell you the number of young ladies who would come to an NABJ conference and give her the wow treatment, if you will. And she'd go, girl, shut up. Come on over here. Let me talk to you.
She's a rock star, but she was a rock star to us. She indeed was a rock star to us. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. I'm Catalina Byrd, sitting in for Sean Yost, as we say goodbye to one of the greatest journalists of all time, Gwen Ifill.
Let me also talk about somebody that everybody has probably heard of and may or might not realize that they're related, and that's Sherilyn Ifill. Sherilyn Ifill is now in charge of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. The two of them are cousins. And let me tell you, when you got them off the stage and pulled them to the side, they act like girlfriends that go way, way back. You know how that goes.
Right,
you know? And what it was the Liberation Society. I'm reminded of about 3 years ago, the two of them came to the Enoch Pratt Library and did a Q&A because Gwen had her book and Sherlyn had her book. And to hear the two of them talk about politics and law was like a master's class.
Right. I can only imagine. And you know, as you keep talking about it, about NABJ, and we tried to get Carla Wills to be able to join us for this segment, but
she's probably working.
She's working, and so we probably couldn't. But you know, I think about all of the times that you all have asked me to join NABJ and to be active in NABJ, and I always say I don't have time. It's another next thing I know, it's an election year again, and I'm covering it wherever I'm covering it, and to hear how active she was in listening to you and your stories, am I disappointed in myself that I didn't create a space for that? Because then it wouldn't just have been a person who was a rock star to me on TV that I wanted to be like in this craft. I would have actually have had the opportunity to meet her and have, like you said, a conversation and learn from her. So while I still learned a great deal of things, I'm definitely going to make sure that I take you and Carla up on your request and become more active in NABJ as well. So not to miss that opportunity again, as we are, as you say, all of us aren't going to always be here. And so I can help play a role in cultivating the next black women and black people that cover politics specifically in this field, as well as learn from the rest of the wisdom and the elders that are still active and a part while I can, because that was a missed opportunity on my part.
Let me talk a little bit about Gwen and her role as one of the premier black political reporters in America. I was the regional director for NABJ, and I have been doing political conferences for political reporters because you've heard me say this, if you cover politics, you're never going to be out of a job. And that is true. You know, the other part is that my good friend Sonia Ross, who is the co-founder of the NABJ Political Reporters, knew that we had to have a big name to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And who calls us both on the phone and says, hold on, Charles, I got Sonia on the other line. Now, what the hell are we going to do now? You know, and I was like, well, Gwen, whatever you want to do, we'll make that happen. So, I'm always reminded of, on the eve of Barack Obama being sworn in, NABJ held a fundraiser in Washington, D.C., and the guest was Gwen Ifill, and it was the launch of her book. Now, of course, everybody bought one. Of course, I've got one that's signed, and of course, you know, when I heard this, I went back, and my wife is there, and of course, you know, my wife gets starstruck by everybody she sees at conferences, which is okay, you know. But she said, Charles, isn't that woman, that the woman we met in Las Vegas? I'm like, yes, that's Gwen. She says, she's really cool. I said, no, she's more than cool. She's really special. And, of course, Gwen addressed a packed crowd that included the black governor of New York, and I can't think of it, David, the blind guy.
David Dinkins?
Not Dinkins, no. The one who had to take over for Spitzer.
Oh, now that you made me forget his
right.
name. Wait, we have a caller.
Let's take a call. Sorry, I didn't mean to monopolize the conversation.
It's okay. Nicole's calling from Towson. Good evening, and welcome to First Edition.
Good evening to you and your guest. I want to thank you guys for covering this. Gwen was such an awesome, awesome person. And, you know, I remember watching her on PBS, and I loved watching her show. She was so professional, just great at what she did, but she came across as someone with such an unbelievable spirit, and I was floored this afternoon when I heard of her passing, and I miss her terribly already. I'm almost at a loss for words. I can't believe she's gone. But I do want to call in and say thank you for covering this, because, you know, I really believe that the world has lost an awesome person.
Thank you, Nicole. Because I came into the studio, and it's been a crazy day. My email was hacked, and I'd gotten the news, and I couldn't even process it. And my first words my first words to the producer were, "Are we talking about Gwen Ifill's passing?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Well, what segment can we move, please? Because while I'm guest hosting only this one day, is it important to me to be able to sit in this chair on this campus and have this conversation about her?"
So, I'm so glad you did.
Thank you
very much.
Let me also talk about Gwen's work at PBS. First and foremost, Gwen, understand that the news hour has gone through many machinations. It was called the McNeil-Lehrer Report before it was called the news hour. And when McNeil decided that he wasn't going to do it anymore, Lerner, remember, was the anchor. Lerner realized that I can't do this forever. And PBS made one of the boldest moves ever. They named two women as the anchor of their signature news program.
Mm-hmm.
That was Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff. But Gwen she didn't want more, but they asked her, could she do more? And they named her the anchor of Washington Week. If the NBC show Meet the Press is the gold standard for the Sunday talk shows,
right,
then the Fridays were the gold standard of Washington Week.
Right.
Because she could bring in literally anybody and everybody.
And did.
And these were people who were reporting on the front lines. And she didn't shy away from controversial subjects. And she usually kind of set the tone for the weekend for all the other talk shows. Because if Gwen Ifill got you on her show, Meet the Press was asking, can you come on our show?
Right.
Or Fox News would say, can you come on our show? And, that was a unique feather in her cap. You know, think about it from this perspective. There are no people of color anchoring 11 o'clock shows on commercial television.
Nope.
Let me repeat that. There are no persons of color anchoring the variety shows that happen at 11 o'clock. The argument has gone like this. Well, they might turn off viewers.
Hmm.
Which, you know, to me is absurd. But
and insulting.
And insulting. But when PBS made the decision to put Gwen on, not only did they get a known quantity, a smart quantity, but an individual who had, as we like to say, worked in the vineyard long before the vineyard had opened. And most people don't realize Gwen comes along at a time when women are still discounted for covering politics.
Hello. of all people that know.
Right. And it's still tough today, but think about in the 70s.
I can only imagine.
These are, you know, the term chauvinistic pig is alive and well. And to have a black woman asking a white politician tough questions was, who do you work for?
Right.
And Gwen not only was good at it, but she broke stories. She wasn't a go-along-to-get-along person. She never, ever was. And I think, you know, look, we're in tenuous times now, and a lot of people wonder, will black folks be able to survive this?
We're going to be fine.
Well, I always say that. You know, I've said that, you know, long before this election began and ended. But we do need people who don't look like everybody in the room.
Right.
I have been the only black in that room for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I will joke with anybody about it. You know, the question used to be, why is Charles here? Now the question is, why isn't Charles here?
And, you know, it's funny that you say that because at the other public radio station here in town, my friend of mine, Kenny Burns, is often the you over there. You know, it's like, and that's where I think most of my sadness comes from, is knowing that I know two incredible black male journalists who are still the only black guy in the room in 2016. And if you ain't get it, if there's not even more men of color in there, how much longer will it be before there are women of color in there too? And you know, and what is our role? How do we get there? Who is creating opportunities for us? Are we not looking in the right places? I mean, it's just, it's so disheartening because we have these conversations in private, you know, when we see each other as colleagues, and we're still so underrepresented. And in this tenuous time, as you say right now, where our representation and our voice is going to be so important to help our people get through the emotions of this election and really calm down and begin to understand what we do going forward. I don't know that I feel hopeful about where these spaces are going and where these students that you introduced me to are going to get to be able to go work or do if we haven't fixed this problem still for so long.
Let me talk to the audience, because I sometimes wonder if the audience understands the power that they have. You know, I've worked in several markets across the country. And of course, you know, I am of the community. I always have been and always will be. As a listener to this radio station, in other places where you see and hear me, if you don't see me, please call them people up and tell them, where the hell is Charles? Because they have to answer that question. Just as they have to answer, why isn't Catalina on Square Off? Or why isn't, you know, Catalina on with Sean?
Right.
You literally have the power. You know, if send that email campaign, you know, tell your friends. You know, you're not going to always agree with what I say. I try and be truthful and factful. And
I don't want to cut you off, but we're running out of time. And we have a small piece of sound I want to play of Gwen Ifill introducing herself. Thanks again, Charles Robinson, for joining us. You're listening to WEAA. We'll be right back. Let's hear it one more time.
Good evening from Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm Gwen Ifill of the NewsHour and Washington Week on PBS. Welcome to the first and the only 2008 vice presidential debate between the Republican nominee, Governor Sarah Palin of Alaska, and the Democratic nominee, Joe Biden of Delaware. The Commission on Presidential Debates is the sponsor of this event, and the two remaining presidential...